Blog Talk Radio.
Here we go.
Let's get lost in a better place. Pick up a bird, travel through time and space. So much to learn, so much to see. A chance to escape reality. Open your mind. In your heart, gain new knowledge, get a fresh new start. MJ Network will bring you there. So let's talk about it when life and on the air.
That was created by Rachel and Michael of Trinity House Entertainment.inc. And yeah, we are so live on the air with the author of Speed the Dawn, Philip Donnelly. So for those of you that love, well, we'll tell you, the tension begins on the first page as hundreds of white-hot media fragments destroy Earth in many places. I don't know if you'd want to be there. Monterey Bay, California is the hottest hit, and once the fires start, nothing can stop the carnage and death tolls that take place. Huge fires destroy the once picturesque landscape, and the power grid collapses as the fires move swiftly, taking down buildings, roads, and anything in its path. And that is the first paragraph of my review, to be honest, and the author is right here. Philip Donnelly, good morning. I'm so glad you decided to do this. Welcome to MJ Network.
Friends, glad to be here. It's a good day to do this.
So, please give us, listeners, how did you create Echo Watch, and why did you decide to create this with the fires and the tsunami and all of that? How come you chose that particular topic?
Well, the topic, the series, Speed the Dawn is the eighth book in the series. So we have to jump way back to 2001 or 2002 when I was trying to dream up a character and a series. And my background is I was a professional pilot for 30 years. So
Oh, nice.
The old adage, you write what you know, right? So it and I've been in a lot of places in the world, and so when I was dreaming this up, the first kind of action-packed theme that I came up with was a hurricane. It was Category 5. And so it just kind of – everything else kind of fell into place. So why would anybody be out at, you know, flying around a hurricane? And it's like, well, environmental researchers would be doing that, and they do that. So – that just sort of by default became Eco Watch, and Donovan Nash is my character. And that book came out in 2004, and it's still one of my best-selling books. And it sets the stage for the whole Eco Watch crew and the camaraderie. And what I have really enjoyed is that because of what they do, it takes them to environmental hotspots all around the world. And so. The first book is Category 5. The second book was Code Black, which is the highest level of snow emergency at Chicago O'Hare Airport. There's Aftershock, which deals with volcanoes. Deadly Echoes, which deals with eco-terrorism. And finally, it was time to do this kind of unchecked forest fire story for a while. I spend a lot of my time in Montana during the summer writing, and I've seen the fires firsthand, and it really does strike something primal inside of us that says run. So that's kind of the background in broad strokes of how EcoWatch came to be, and it's been a wonderful vehicle. And for me to get to go research, I'm like a little kid, you know. It's like I talk to the experts. I've been to the tower at O'Hare Airport, and this one in particular, which deals with this, again, this unchecked fire, it's a huge fire. And I was in Montana, and I got to go to the U.S. Forest Service Fire Lab that is outside of Missoula. And I made an appointment, got to go talk to this scientists about fire and how they're made and how they grow and just all of the physics of it. And then he looked at me and he says, "You want to go make a fire tornado?" And we went in the lab, and we made a fire tornado. You can imagine a dust devil or an actual tornado, only it's fire. And it's, you know, that's gonna be the star of this book. So it's fun. It's, you know, it's a fun topic. It's a fun series. And, you know, the great beach read. So you might want to be careful exactly which beach you're on.
I know. So I felt that very first scene. And the scene with Lauren and her team and react to the debris from the meteorite and the damages, I could actually see it in my head. And I closed my eyes and said, gee, I'm glad I'm reading the book and I'm not there. So how did you create that?
Right.
Because it was so real that I was shaking, oh, my God, it's almost like a hurricane coming, or even worse. This was worse. So how did you create that scene, and why did you choose Monterey as a choice for a disaster? Poor people in California never know what hit them ever.
Well, I looked at this, and I did plan all this before the really awful last 2 years of California fire. So what I wanted, and in this book, is for the first time I'm featuring one of EcoWatch's ships. So I needed a place where a ship could figure prominently in this. And I also needed a place where we could start the fire. And then I needed a larger place, as in the Bay Area, to be at risk. So all of that comes together and tells me Monterey. And the character, Donovan Nash, who is a man with an extraordinary secret, once lived in Monterey. And so that sort of allowed me some other little devices to play with that were intriguing to me. So Monterey it was. So I actually went to Monterey. I spent 2 months there, rented a house, and ran around and kind of just collected all of the, you know, all the juicy details. I think sense of place is very important in these books. And there was going to be a lot of detail in that regard because, you know, the infrastructure, the architecture, the topography, all of that comes into play with a big fire. So, it's not a bad place to hang out and write a book either. So I was happy with that location.
I was scared
writing,
for the whole thing, let me tell you. Yeah.
Well, it is scary. And in writing the book, the first scene with when they're in the airplane, and what happens is a meteor comes, and it's not a doomsday meteor, and it actually breaks up as it hits the atmosphere, and what it does, it collides with a bunch of the low Earth orbiting satellites that are floating around out there. Space is kind of a junkyard, and I ran across this little tidbit. It's called the Kessler effect, and there was a scientist that theorized that someday it's going to be like playing pool, and something's going to hit something, and you're just going to have this domino effect, and all of these satellites we have up there are going to get are just going to be worthless. So there's small particles coming down from the meteor, and then there's satellites, and it creates havoc. So as it rains down on the airplanes, it would do exactly what it did. It was just like it's like a shotgun blast. So some areas get hit, some don't, but every place where a meteorite actually makes it to the ground is going to start burning. So, and if you're on the very edge of it and you're in an airplane, that's a dangerous place to be, and it was. And fortunately, the airplane didn't come apart, but they managed to get it on the ground, and then the action really starts.
You know, I'm not a very great flyer, and that scared me, and that convinced me to stay on the ground, seriously, after that.
Well,
it's like, oh, my God, yeah.
That
could happen,
I
guess.
What I tell people is that you should take great relief in that there are pilots out there that that can get you on the ground. So, but it's not, maybe this is not the vacation book to read while you're flying to vacation. Save this one until you get to the beach.
Well, the last time I flew, this is a while ago, there was so much turbulence that I literally had to hang on and take two seatbelts. It was so bad. And it was like, oh, my God, are we going to get down? The going to Florida was fine. Coming back, the steward and I were sitting in, like, he was like, he couldn't even move. It was so bad. And although, but I was honored, though, because when they found out that I do a radio show, they invited me into the cockpit to sit with the pilot.
Oh, wow.
So that was, it was. I was like, oh, my God. Yeah. Would you like to meet the pilot? I go, would you like to meet the guy that's making the plane shake? So, no, they treated me like I was a rock star. I was like, oh, my God. So then I did write something nice about them and reviewed it, and they even emailed me to thank me, JetBlue. So who are Michael and Rick, and what happens that causes more serious problems and let Laura know that she'll have to do more than just be a passenger on the plane? I mean, what do you do if you don't have a Lauren on the plane to, you know, take things in control? That scared me, too. Oh, boy.
Well, without a Lauren, you have a book that's half as good. She's my go-to gal. I love writing her. The way I write these books is there's her husband, Donovan Nash, and he provides one point of view, and Lauren is... And she's awesome. She's the smartest one in the room. Doesn't even matter what room it is. She's the smartest one in there. She's got advanced degrees from MIT. She's a meteorological analyst for the Defense Intelligence Agency. So she helps. One of the little fragments hits the co-pilot. So there's medical needs that need to be taken care of. Michael is Donovan's best friend and the number two guy at EcoWatch, and they're all coming to Monterey. Donovan's already there. They're coming to Monterey to meet and get out to the ship, the brand new ship, and it's a ceremony. It's a handoff ceremony that EcoWatch is working with the Monterey Bay Aquarium, and they're loaning the ship to the scientists at Monterey Bay to study the Earth's oceans. So it's a big party. I mean, it's a big celebration. Everybody's happy. Donovan is at the aquarium. He's waiting for them to show up. And Michael's probably the best pilot in the book. He might be even a little better than I am. I'm not sure. Donovan and I are about the same. So, but Michael, Michael's a former Navy pilot. He's got some game. So he gets this Gulfstream on the ground. They get the wounded co-pilot kind of attended to, and the EcoWatch helicopter from the ship comes, and they get everybody to San Francisco, but they don't have Donovan. Donovan's missing, and Donovan is with another character we can talk about later. But so Lauren doesn't know where her husband is, other than Monterey is just burning. The whole peninsula is just burning. They witnessed the tsunami. It's not a huge tsunami, but it's enough to knock out some of the roads and along the coast that kind of hamper the evacuations. And it's just a little bit later, Lauren notices that there's been a subtle wind shift. And that's when she starts looking at all the raw data. And she discovers there's this low pressure area that's moving closer, and the winds are going to really start blowing, which for a firefighter is the worst enemy. So it's a race against time. This whole book takes place in 12 hours.
I know, and I felt like it took place. It just I read it, and I won't even tell you. Let's see, people. The book is in front of me. It's not going anywhere, although there are 20 people that have hands out. There are 309 pages, and I read it in less than 2 hours. Seriously, I just sat down and read it. And
that's what people tend to do.
It was a good thing it wasn't raining and there wasn't a storm outside, because probably then I would have been saying, oh, my God, how can I read this? It was so good, really. Anybody who hasn't read it, I don't know. It's different. It's a mystery thriller, but it's different, and it doesn't have murder in it, and it's so much better. So before we continue, I don't know if everybody understands the definition of a tsunami and how catastrophic it is. What exactly is that, and can people evacuate, and what is the best line of defense when the media comes and wants to kill you? How do you do that? Because the tsunamis,
well,
I mean, they happen
defense.
All over the world.
Oh, yeah, they do. And, you know, the meteor thing is such a rare event. There's been a couple that have shown up sort of and surprised us that hit in Russia over the last 15 years. There's really no defense against that. So, you know, that's one of those things that, you know, you just can't prep for it. If you're going to get hit by a meteor, you're going to get hit by a meteor. The tsunami is, when I was a kid, we called them tidal waves, but now they call them tsunamis. And so it's basically a fast moving pulse of energy racing through the ocean, which is fine. They're pretty innocuous when they're out at sea. It's not until you compress that wave against the seafloor, which is what happens when these pressure waves get to land, that the water starts piling up on each other as the wave is slowed by the bottom of the ocean. The water that's coming over the top is pushed up and up and up, and that's where you get this wave, this pressure wave that comes ashore. And that is the only thing you can do. And most places that are prone to them, low-lying areas, have sirens, and there's a warning system, and there are evacuation routes. And those are really, really increased in the last 20 years. And there's a hurricane warning system in Hawaii that monitors the Pacific Ocean, because with all of the seismic equipment that we have, we can predict them, and we can tell if they're coming. And so they move about 500 miles an hour. So a lot of times we'll have hours before they're going to arrive or projected to arrive. And that's plenty of time to just get to high ground. This particular meteor in my book hit right off Monterey. So the tsunami, which was just created by the big displacement of water, rushed into shore fairly quickly. So there was time. They did send the sirens, but the fires had pretty much evacuated the people before the tsunami got there.
There are so many wildfires in California that it's scary that there's no way that they can prevent them, or people still buy the same property and they still have them every single year. There's got to be some way that they could, you know, foretell or do something about it, because, I mean, it's always on the news, and it's really, like,
oh, sure.
Scary.
It is.
Yeah, that is.
Fires have been around forever, and it's actually part of the ecosystem. What makes it problematic is when the fires reach an urban setting. Forest fires are awful, but then you take a forest fire size blaze and push it through an urban area, and it creates all kinds of havoc because there's so much fuel. There's gas lines. There's, you know, propane tanks. There's cars. There's gasoline. And all of that burns. When a house burns, there's all of this synthetic stuff, plastic and whatnot, and it creates just deadly poisonous fumes, you know, from that. So that it's hard for the firefighters. It's hard for the people that are trying to evacuate. It's it's difficult. And, you know, we have there's policies in place that aren't always the right ones. There's not a lot of clear cutting or there's a lot of dead underbrush that's just there, and it's so flammable, and, you know, it should be cleared out, or they should do controlled burns sometimes and get rid of that instead of having a monster burn.
No, I know. So we've got Donovan and Shannon, and they're stuck in the Monterey Aquarium, but Lauren doesn't know that they're there. So when they realize they have to evacuate, but, you know, I was getting, you know, I felt like the water was going over my head, and I don't swim that well. So I'm saying, gee, I don't know if I want to, it was like getting claustrophobic. So when did he realize how to get out, and how did they get out of a place that's filling up with water? That's scary.
Well, they're on this, they're Monterey Aquarium, which is a fabulous place. I love that place. The Donovan realized that the wave was coming when he saw his ship. It was just sitting offshore waiting for them, get underway and head out to sea. The captain knew what was going to happen, turned the bow into the wave and started heading out to sea. The farther you can get away from the shore, the safer you are. And so when Donovan saw the captain do that, he knew what was coming. And as close as they were, and it was a mob scene at the aquarium. It was closing time, but there was a lot of people, and people panic. There's just no way around it. You get that primal, I'm going to die message coming from the oldest part of your brain, and whether it's a tornado, a hurricane, a fire, a stampede of bison, whatever, people panic. And so Donovan did the next best thing. He couldn't get out of the place to go uphill, so they just went up in the aquarium. And they got to a third-story little viewing area that looks out over the water. And Shannon, who is the fiance of a former EcoWatch member who gave his life in the line of duty, the ship is named after him. And she was there for the ceremony. So she's kind of my civilian that I like to have, because they could get to play off each other, and there's a lot of information I can pass using dialogue instead of just narrative, to let the reader know what's going on. So she and Donovan raced to get up to the top, and it, and the structure is concrete, and it holds on. And as the wave recedes, they're able to get out, and the terrain rises fairly quickly right there in Monterey at the aquarium. And so they get up the hill, and there's no cell phone. There's no nothing. The whole power grid has collapsed. So they're on their own. And there's one other part of this equation. There's Donovan's oldest friend, family friend, known him forever. They're business partners. Donovan was supposed to pick him up at a golf course in Pebble Beach. And he's not leaving without William. So they steal a car. Donovan's was underwater. His rental car was underwater pretty much. Or actually, his rental car got stolen. People were coming into parking garages and just, grabbing the keys that were hanging there and pushing buttons to see which one would start. It was chaos. And now off they're going. They're off to Pebble Beach, and it's getting dark. For Donovan to find his best friend, his oldest friend. And Lauren, they're grounded in San Francisco. There's a no-fly rule in effect now because this whole area of California is just a disaster. It really is. And it's not that this can't happen. It hasn't happened yet. I didn't have to make up anything that was far-fetched. And that makes the book even scarier.
I know it did, because I do research when I do these things. Trust me. And I looked it up and go like, this could really happen. Hope it doesn't. I mean, there are a lot of books that I've read where the communications go down, but during a tsunami or a hurricane or something like that, I mean, just around here where I am, thank God the power lines are under the ground, but in a lot of the buildings around here, they go dark the minute it rains or two, or there's a thunderstorm. It's scary. So Lauren has a lot of resources, and what I love about her is that she doesn't care how many rules she has to break. She's going to do it to get what she needs to do, and that's what makes her really great. So who are the organizations that she enlists, and who are Ernie and Calvin? Because she doesn't give up, because she's going to find Donovan, she's going to save lives, and she doesn't care.
No, and that's kind of her, and she wasn't always that way, and that's been another one of the fun parts about this series is that she was, they've had kind of a rocky relationship over the years, but they're really doing well now. But Donovan Nash is a big personality, and he is a he's a take charge alpha male, and you know, but he's not a Navy SEAL, he's not a James Bond, or pretty smart, and he's got lots and lots of resources, and so she had to kind of spool up to be married to him because he seems to always be in harm's way, and so she's grown a lot. And then there's another character. Her name's just Montero. And they're the two of the strongest women I've ever run across. And they kind of – Montero's former FBI. And she is – of all the people in the book, she's the one I would least like to go up against. So
yeah, me too.
Those two women – yeah. Those two women together are a force. And so, and that's what I think makes this book. I get more compliments from the female readers. That's like, I can't thank you enough. I can't believe you have not one but two ultra strong women that aren't just, you know, arm candy. And it's like, thank you. And I don't do arm candy in my books. So,
true.
So, yeah, so Lauren is, you know, she's with the Defense Intelligence Agency. She's a consultant. She was with them full-time, but now she's got other things going on. They have she and Donovan have an 8-year-old daughter who was fortunately in Virginia. That's where they live during all of this book. Sometimes I include Abigail in the books. Sometimes she's better off at daycare. So Lauren... they get to San Francisco in the helicopter, and now they have power. They have communications. It's just this whole area, this Monterey County, basically, that's just out. So she gets a hold of the Defense Intelligence Agency, and then she's working in conjunction with CAL FIRE, which is the organization within California that deals with firefighting. And then we have the National Forest Service. And then we have Homeland Security. So there's kind of a political bent to this. CAL FIRE guys, that's their mission is to go fight the fire. They're the guys. And in fact, in the very first line of the acknowledgments, I make a comment about that the book is dedicated to first responders because they're the unique part of the human race that will run toward the danger instead of away, and they're an amazing bunch, and I got to hang out with some of them while I was writing this book. So CAL FIRE's got the fire thing, Forest Service is part of that as well, and then you've got Lauren, who has connections with the military because she's with the Defense Intelligence Agency, and she can get heard at the highest levels. So she sees things that others she kind of collects information from all these sources and comes up with a daring plan to maybe keep the fire from spreading all the way to the Bay Area, where it's just going to be the second great San Francisco fire if it gets there.
Well, and there's the whole time a whole lot more that they don't know.
Yeah.
Well, what caused the communication to go down? And she's worried about Donovan. But what role does Homeland Security play? And who is Frederick Price and Buckley? But the communications go down. You can almost tell that the electric lines are going to blow up or something. So what role do these other people play in order to help her? Because she's got roadblocks there, and they're not going to let her, you know, just do everything. There's red tape and everything.
Right. So the Homeland Security, they put up a no-fly zone because even after the meteor passes, there's still satellite debris coming down because there's the low Earth. There's a whole swath of the low Earth orbiting satellites that are damaged and they're coming down and some of those satellites are information satellites. Some of them are weather satellites. There's communication satellites. The fires completely knock out the power grid, and then. I kind of look at the area, and it's like, okay, the nearest power station to Monterey is just up the road on the beach at Moss Landing, and it's a coal-fired power station, or natural gas power station. So I'm thinking, well, you know, the tsunami is going to take that out, or at least, you know, shut it down. So no electric power. There's the cell towers. They go down. They all require electricity. It was a pretty easy, you know, task to knock out all that stuff. So no landlines, no cell phones. They do have an AM radio in the car they stole, and they heard the emergency broadcast, you know, that the state puts out, their county puts out. It's like, evacuate, just evacuate Monterey County. And they do. And it was, and so Homeland Security was involved in the no-fly zone and getting clearance for EcoWatch and Lauren and the team to go out to the ship where there's far superior communications, that is a scientific ship. And the Buckley is the ship that was named after the former EcoWatch employee lost his life or gave his life in the line of duty. So it is, you know, it's kind of the ship is kind of a character in itself. This book doesn't really have any bad guys. There's one sort of moody criminal that was looting, but, you know, in the terms of the disaster, he's not a big deal. But the ship is one of those characters, and the fire itself becomes a character. And so I had those tools to work with. There really aren't that many characters. I mean, we just kind of jump back and forth between, you know, Donovan and Lauren and what it is they're doing to try to survive. And neither one of them knows if the other's alive. And I think that adds a little bit of tension to everything. Lauren can't think about the fact that Donovan might be dead. She doesn't know. She has to just force herself to say, if I save as many people as I can, maybe Donovan will be one of them. So,
well, I was hoping that you wouldn't kill off anybody.
Well, I don't think I did too much damage.
Well, my other favorite character.
Yes.
My other favorite character is Montero, because she's a lot like me, and she doesn't still hold barred, and she just I know, I like her. She's distant. She's cold. She's efficient. And she doesn't take, and she takes no prisoners. So how did you create her? And yeah, you know what? I'm glad that you created two female characters that don't make women look mamby-pamby. Because I read a lot of books, I'm thousands of them, and sometimes I want to slap the character in the head. Like yesterday, one of the characters was like, that I just finished reading, and I'm like, oh my God, wake up, do you see what's in front of you? Are you there? And what happened, why is she the way she is? How did you create her? And I hope you bring her back. Seriously.
She was, she showed up in book 3. And she and Donovan were adversaries. She was kind of a damaged, in pain FBI agent. She had lost her love of her life, basically, in a freak mission with the FBI that was sort of her fault, that it went bad, and he died. And she was on a vendetta. And so this is in southern Florida. So Donovan and Michael show up, and they interrupt a crew that are stealing a Gulfstream jet, Boca Raton Airport. Michael gets shot, and the FBI shows up. Montero's there. She starts doing some digging, and she discovers Donovan's got this huge secret. And anyone else would have exposed him and let the world know that the man he used to be is still alive. Donovan re-engineered his life. We all like a do-over, I think, at some point. and Donovan has the means to do it. And so he engineered and faked his own death, massive facial reconstruction, and became Donovan Nash. So she finds out the truth. Well, she's so blinded by her vendetta, her rage, she blackmails him into helping her find the people responsible for killing the love of her life. And Donovan really doesn't have any choice. So they become their adversaries all the way through the book. But they uncover a plot that's way bigger. So she gets what she wants. She kind of owes Donovan. She keeps her word. She's unorthodox methods, but she does have integrity. So we don't see her again until a couple books later, and Lauren is in trouble and reaches out to her to come help. And so that kind of makes her she's on the Eco Watch team temporarily, and she's such a great character. Of all the characters that I would consider maybe spinning off to have their own series, I think it would be.
I agree with you. She's better than the Secret Service or than an armed guard, I'll tell you that. She's a one-woman force. You don't need anybody else if you have Montero.
No, and she is. She really showed her colors in Pegasus Down when they were trying to save some people in Europe and didn't know where they were. And so it was, you know. And what I like is she has some skills, but. But everyone, for the most part, you know, they're thinking their way through these problems. They're not shooting their way through these problems. You know, I like that aspect of these books. And it's, you know, Donovan, sometimes he just gets the snot beat out of him because he's not James Bond. And so sometimes he gets slowed down. He got hurt. He got hurt in this book. And, you know, had to limp his way through the last 100 pages. So, you know, I try to make them as real as possible, as the people as real as possible.
Well, if there weren't any flaws and it was too easy to save them, I probably would have been, you know, said like that. That can't really happen. So they finally get out. They find William. And then they try to stabilize him. And Donovan is hurt. And they need an infirmary. This was original. How did you get him to be able to even stabilize him? How did you create those scenes where, you know, he's... You don't know who's going to live and who's going to die, especially William. And I'm saying, well, is Donovan going to be okay? And is Shannon not going to fall apart, which he didn't? So how did you create that? That was really, he's in need of hurt and in infirmary. So what recourse do they have? How did you figure that out? That was ingenious,
well,
seriously.
Well, thank you. You know, William was hurt. And that's just, you know, that's a huge distraction for Donovan. I mean, this man is a father figure. He raised him. And Shannon didn't come apart, but she wavered pretty close to the edge a couple of times. So, because they're just, you know, at night, nights come and they're stuck. You know, they're in a part that's not burning. All they can do is wait till morning, which is sort of a hint of the tidal speed, the dawn. But William needs help. He needs medical help. And so they go to the hospital. I mean, you know, they leave William where he is because he's not going to travel very well. And so they get to the hospital. The hospital's been evacuated, as they will. What the county does is they evacuate hospitals, assisted living, retirement homes, prisons. This happened on a weekend, so there weren't schools in session. But there's a whole plan, and it's online. You can read how it's done. But they do a good job in getting, you know, everybody out. So what Donovan was afraid of is this place was going to be empty. But he didn't know. So they may make the trip to the hospital, and they need at least some rudimentary medical supplies. So they start going through the emergency room and, you know, getting gauze and elastic bandages and splints and stuff like that they can find. But what they really like to find is something to help William with the pain. And so Shannon wanders off to the operating room or the pharmacy. She's following the signs. And Donovan hears her scream. And all he has is a crowbar. Mm. But he runs to help her. And so that's these criminals that are in there. They're looters. They're looking for the drugs too. And
yeah.
So they're attacking Shannon, and Donovan dispatches them because they don't see him coming. And so now they have the compounded problem of some angry bikers that are looking for retribution. So that's a side plot, but it ratchets up the uncertainty of Donovan and Shannon's situation.
Before I forget, I don't want to forget, next Wednesday, the author of Evil Winds, Michael Shushko, will be here. Trey Crest, Praise 2. We're going to talk about Darfur and the refugees. It's a really powerful book. On the 21st, none other than one of my favorite people, Alan Jacobson, will be here with The Dark Side of the Moon. And anyone that wants to know how to be, what happens when you get to the moon or to become an astronaut, he does a lot of research. It's fantastic. On the 27th, none other than Tess Gerritsen is going to do an exclusive interview with me about her new movie. It's a horror, people. Island Zero. Heidi, and then I take the rest of the month off of July, and we start back on August 1st with Hiding, Jenny Morton Potts. That's an interesting psychological thriller. And on the 6th, we have Connie DeMarco and Tale of a Dragon, and that's just some of what's coming up in August. All the way, the show is booked till December 4th, which is pretty good. We have some dates left in October and November, but until October, we are booked. So what happens when Laura knows there's another crisis, there's a tropical depression? How would that change things? And how are these disasters followed at the same time? We've got the meteor, we've got the tsunami, now we have a tropical depression. How come you included that? I was like, oh, my God, no.
Well, there's, the weather happens,
So
what... And it's not a hurricane, it's not a typhoon or anything like that. It's an area of low pressure, and it's kind of moving in. It creates wind, and it in and of itself would mean nothing. If you've ever been to the golf courses in Pebble Beach, and they're some of the most beautiful courses in the world, actually, and watch them play at Pebble Beach, the wind comes roaring in off the ocean. And on a windy day, a club that would be like a pitching wedge is a 5-iron because there's so much wind. So it's like that's the big variable in fighting fires. If it's calm, you can actually tackle one of these fires and make some progress. If the winds kick up, you just got to get out of the way. So I needed enough wind to make this fire big enough and potentially fast moving enough to move all the way to the Bay Area, which would just be an unmitigated disaster. So Lauren is the first, she's on the ground there. So she sees the wind shift, and she starts working her MIT math magic and figures out what's going to happen. And she gets together with the Forest Service. They start theorizing, what's going to happen. And then she comes across Googling just an obscure little footnote about fire tornadoes. And they have happened. They do exist. You can go on YouTube and find them. The one I got to make in the lab was awesome and scary. So she gets on the phone with the Forest Service and CAL FIRE, and it's like, this is what I think is going to happen. And then for big problems, sometimes you need big solutions. And I'm not going to divulge what she does or what she recommends, but it's big and dangerous. And it may even kill Donovan if he's not already dead. So she's, that's her quandary. And Donovan's quandary is he needs to get out. And he's running out of time. So it's a, the last 100 pages are just, it's so intense. I mean, it was intense for me to write it. And I knew what was going to happen. You know, I'd get up from the computer and I'd just go, wow, I've got it. I just need to get my breathing under control.
I don't blame you. It was so hot, I thought I was going to need a fire extinguisher, seriously. I mean, you could feel the heat of the fires. It's scary. I mean, I don't like going near matches, personally. I mean, could you imagine a huge fire? So the other character that I love is Janie. She's great.
Yes.
So how did you create her? Because without her, things might not have turned out to be at all. And then when Lauren comes up with a plan to stop everything and she wants the helicopter, she's going to get everybody in trouble. But somehow this girl manages to do the unthinkable. So how does she enlist her? And why would Lauren get in trouble? She's going to get in trouble for what she did. But so what?
Well, yeah, she doesn't. I mean, threatening Lauren with her job or whatever just doesn't work because she and Donovan have tons of money. So, and she's got an attitude. She got that from Donovan and Montero. So all these characters kind of, you know, impact on each other and they all have progressed through the series. And I think that's one of the cool parts about my job is I get to think about character change, evolution, what events might impact a character one way or another. And so Lauren has changed the most in these books, followed by Montero. Janie is a helicopter pilot. We got a bunch of guy pilots flying the airplanes and stuff like that. So I kind of wanted to mix it up. And her quirk is that she's Australian, and she's a little whirlwind all in herself. And she, you can't outdrink Janie. She's Australian. I can speak firsthand to this. They have a skill set in that arena that just doesn't translate to North America. So, and she's kind of quiet, but she has saved the day more than once. She's been around since, I'm not even sure, Deadly Echoes, she saved the day. But they got into trouble. She dinged up the helicopter, and they're trapped on the ship, and the helicopter's essentially, it's unflyable. And so when they finally have a lead where they think maybe Donovan is going to be, they need the helicopter. Because that's the fastest way to get to him and extract him. But it's not going to fly. And so Janie makes a bold decision. And I know helicopter guys, and I ran this past them, and I had read a story clear back in the Vietnam era that some GIs in the Army had a damaged helicopter, had a hole, bullet hole through the rotor blade out toward the tip or something, and that makes it unbalanced, and it'll just shake itself apart. So they basically recreated the hole on the other side. Just a battlefield balancing act. And it didn't run very good, but it did fly barely. So Janie kind of engineers that, and it's really touch and go if that's going to work. So that was, you know, and Janie's just, you know, she's determined. You know, she's everybody in this book. And they are this way, because having been a pilot, you know, you have an organization of highly trained, highly motivated people. They are exceptionally task-oriented. So I did transfer that to EcoWatch. And, you know, it's like
It is the same with sort of the what I would call the counterparts. If you watch an operating room or an emergency room or a fire station, highly trained, highly tasked people that are ultra motivated, and lives count. I mean, that's what happens in that situation. So everybody works at the highest level, and so we pull some stuff off. It's that, again, I never do anything that's impossible because it just doesn't work for me. So it might be improbable, but it could happen, and maybe it has happened. So I get Googled a lot. My readers tell me, it's like, I never knew about this. And then I Googled the Kessler effect, and it's real.
Yeah, I did also.
Like,
I did also.
Yeah, I know.
I,
and it's like,
I Googled
yeah.
tsunamis. I Googled everything, you know, because when it's got research in it, I like to make sure that when I write my review that I'm right and that the author's right. So we have about 8 minutes, but this I have to ask this question. When they have to fly and she's told, you better not, what pull does she get in order to get permission to fly? And when they realize that there are others in danger and they could just, you know, land and be safe, what does Janie do? Because she's really amazing. And Lauren gets around it. How does she get around being told, you can't do that, but I'm going to do it anyway?
Well, she's got, again, she's got this attitude. And she,
yeah, I like it.
And she's the smart, and she's the smartest person in the room. So she knows what needs to be done, and she's really not one to let some guy, be it a general in the Pentagon, tell her what to do. So, in fact, one of my favorite scenes in the book, because she's come a long way. Lauren's come a long way, bless her heart. But when she actually stands out on the deck of the Buckley, the ship,
mm-hmm.
and flips off the drone that she knows is up there, it sends the live feed to the Pentagon, to the general that she's not happy with. That made me smile. That scene still makes me smile. So she just does it, you know, and Michael, who's kind of a wisecracker sometimes, he's like, you know, his philosophy is, you know, it's better to say I'm sorry than to get permission. And that's sort of his mantra. So they don't really care. And just kind of based on the times, you know, and I have to say that I've not been terribly thrilled with the bureaucracy of our country right now. So,
oh, no kidding.
It was, yeah. So it was kind of a way for me to kind of just flip them all off too. And there is political infighting. And I think I had a good friend read the book and he loved it. And he said, best line ever. Lauren is talking to the Pentagon and she says, we've got, I'm not going to even, I can't even quote myself today. Oh, that's terrible. We got a full-fledged political shitstorm here, something like that, because all the bureaucracies are fighting back and forth, and she wants to make things happen. So there's a lot of that, and I think it shows in the book, you know, a little bit. But they put the area under martial law and told them to stay out of the way, and Lauren wouldn't do it, and so they managed to rescue some people that maybe.
Well, things calmed down, and she's in deep trouble. So if in real life, would that really happen? Would they try to fire her or arrest her, or they brought her in? And seriously, would that happen? I mean, that I was saying that don't you dare fire her. They could. They would, wouldn't they? They would crucify her in the news, too, probably.
Well, yeah. I mean, somebody has to. First of all, she made them look bad, and that's the worst.
Yeah,
thing
I know, and that's what made me feel good, that she did make them look bad, yeah.
Yeah, and then Donovan had his little card up his sleeve to play, which I liked. So, you know, I think the government could absolutely make a knee-jerk, stupid reaction, and then have to, we see it every day. And then they have to back it up. They have to, you know, walk it backwards and change their song and dance and And they did. And it all worked out, you know. And Lauren is pretty much the star of the book, I think. Everyone else was just reacting. Mm-hmm. She was about the only one being proactive. And she was, and she did it teetering on the edge of losing her control because she had every reason to believe that her husband was dead.
Well, before we end the character, I hope you bring back Shannon, and I hope you bring back Montero. And what is next for these characters? Because I have to know when to put it in my schedule again.
Well, I appreciate that.
Seriously,
there's several projects underway right now. You know, Donovan Nash will be back. That's a given. Lauren will be back. Montero will be back. And, you know, I did have to kind of shake my head the other day of my series of books. There's quite a few of them in play right now. There's fires in New Mexico. There's a volcano in Guatemala, which is what my book Aftershock dealt with. There's hurricane season has just started. So, you know, if you want to observe some of these books firsthand from the safety of your living room, Category 5 is the place to start and get to know these characters and follow them all the way through Speed the Dawn, and by the time you get there, there'll probably be a new one.
Well, I hope, when are you going to write the new one, and have you started it yet? And if everybody wants to read this, just look at the cover of the book. Oh my God, you're going to be hot and want to, you know, get a whole bunch of water and start squirting it at the fire. You could feel the heat in the cover of the book. Seriously. So, did you start a new one?
There's notes and thoughts and it's kind of my process in the summer is to kind of start organizing things. I do want to add this. It is a series, but they're all written as standalones, so you can actually jump in anywhere and have a fully, you know, a full Donovan Nash encounter, I guess, and not feel like you're visiting somebody else's high school reunion.
Well, that's true. I did a panel show the other day with Charles Salzberg and Dick Belsky and Bruce Coffin and Alan Topol, and we talked about endings that are open-ended where you know that the villain and the bad guy's coming back, and it was a lot of fun. Right. But as you said, character changes, you know, like Lauren and Donovan, I'm thinking in October, because I just booked a show with Charles and through two other people that I've never interviewed before, Tim O'Mara and Ron Wes Clavin, for their trilogy. I'm thinking about in October possibly doing one on a character in a series and how they change and how their personalities grow or change. So if I do that, can I email you? Would you be interested in doing that?
Sure.
With like two or three other people?
Yeah.
Oh, good.
Yeah. You know,
those are my most fun.
Because some characters never evolve. Like,
I know. Tell me about it.
Like,
Well,
like Sherlock Holmes, it never changes.
I know.
But he's brilliant, genius. And there's a subject the authors get animated about.
Well, considering I read thousands of books, seriously, the one character that never changes, but I love him, is Hercule Poirot. I love him. Those are my favorites.
Yep.
But can you tell everybody where to find you and where they can find your work?
You can find my work on Amazon, every independent bookstore. My website is www.philipdonnelly.com. And just every place that books are found, you'll find me. So the newest book is Speed the Dawn. Google that. And you'll have all the information that you want to know on how to track down me or my books. Through the website, there is an email. I see all those. So if you'd like to ask a question or have something clarified or whatever, reach out. I like interacting with the fans.
Well, thank you so much for today. I appreciate it. And I definitely will be emailing you probably in August or September to come up with another panel show with some other authors. this book is great for those of you, you know, Father's Day is in, you know, 2 weeks. And like I've been saying, books are the best present. Well, to me, they're the book's present. I just have to ask for something, and I pray to God that I get it. This is great. So Speed the Dawn is one book that you might want to consider. Robert Zagoni's book, I just read it. It's fantastic. A Steep Price is coming out on June 26th. This is the fun part of doing what I do, because I get everything before it comes out, which is really exciting. Clive Gussler's book, The Grey Ghost, I just started it. And I received The Pharaoh's Key by Douglas Preston and Lincoln Child. I started that yesterday, too. I tend to read 5 or 6 at a time so that it keeps my mind going. But I want to thank you so much, everyone. It looks like it's going to rain, but don't worry about it. It's still a beautiful day. And, Philip, thank you so much. Everybody have a nice day, and bye.
Bye-bye.